This idea of the one person billion-dollar company, is that hyperbole, or do you think that's actually going to be a reality soon?
That is the question.
Amjad Masad, co-founder and CEO of Replit, a billion-dollar AI startup revolutionizing software development.
Nothing I would do just for fun. I always wanted to be the best.
Is that driven by a pure inspiration, or is that driven by insecurity?
Both, probably.
How should people rethink how they learn to thrive in a post-AI world?
You have to differentiate, and you have to be a little bold and attracted to boldness. There's no leader, there's no personality in the world that is not polarizing to some extent.
Amjad is a contrarian entrepreneur on a mission to unlock human potential through AI and make building technology accessible to billions of people. What is one skill or trait that you would program into every human?
Truly understanding how people see you, and it is a spiritual journey, and what's holding you back is you.
I think one of the biggest benefits of AI is leverage on our time. And you no longer need to learn advanced programming for 10 years to build an app. Like, you have Replit for that now, right? Soon we might not even have to learn how to drive. Everything will be Waymo or a Waymo competitor. So I'm curious, from your macro standpoint, how should people rethink what they learn and how they learn to thrive in a post-AI world?
That is the question. And, you know, everyone's getting distracted by, you know, AGI is going to kill us all and all these, you know, doomer science fiction scenarios. And very few people are actually thinking about how do we teach our children the valuable skills for this new world. How should we all learn? How should we all adapt? Where I see from our customers, right? So with Replit, we remove the need for coding skill. Now, people sometimes mistake that for removing all of skill. No, this is removing the coding skill. Coding is a pedantic thing. Interacting with a machine in a sort of this very discrete, precise way, which is not how humans think. And now we have a layer on top of how machines work that is more fuzzy and able to understand humans at our level, which is large language models. So large language models also happen to be able to generate great code, and increasingly more. And so you have this translator layer. And so that removes the need to learn code, to suffer through code. And but that shifts the skill, right? Like, now most of your time is figuring out what to build, why to build it, and doing like more productive things, such as talking to your customers, figuring out your place in the market, iterating, but also taking complex ideas and breaking them down into actionable things, having a roadmap, all of these things that are in and around the core act of software engineering become more and more important. So how does that affect how we reinvent our education system? I would say we need to focus on creating generalists. So perhaps going more broad and having less specialization, but more high-level knowledge in the different sort of fields, but also focus on critical thinking, system thinking, being generative, perhaps philosophy and ideas. It almost, like, the best way I think about it is almost like going back to ancient Greece. People would go and learn the skill of life, as opposed to like more of these, you know, particular things that you could do in your job.
Right, like the Stoics, like you're learning the fundamental, basically the building blocks of how the world operates, because now you have tools that have democratized access to skills that would have taken a decade to learn, if you could even learn them in the first place. And I think that's an interesting thing, is like, we've talked about now it's more important to learn how to think, right? But that is such an esoteric concept of like, how do I get better at thinking? And it's like, do you recommend that people study first principles or the Stoics, or are there particular bodies of work or things that you would recommend people skill up on to actually build the operating system of thinking?
Yeah. Elon, you see him pop up in all sorts of random areas. You know, right now he's in our government trying to make it more efficient. But actually, one underrated thing that he's done is in education. So when, 10 years ago, he felt like his kids are not getting a proper education. They're going to these very expensive private schools to get indoctrinated as opposed to get educated. And which is crazy here in California, especially, you'll pay $50,000 to send your kid to an ideological indoctrination institution.
It's an expensive cult.
Yeah. Yeah, they should pay you. And so he created a school at SpaceX, and they call it Ad Astra, which means to the star. His main idea is that games are a great way to learn. And their games and simulations are as close to the sort of real world in terms of the kind of skills that you need to pick up. Being agile, thinking on your feet, being a generalist, mm-hmm. and having to learn skills on the fly. So he built a team with another, very skilled educator who had the same ideas. His name is Josh. And they created a school where, first of all, there's no grades in the school. And the school is centered around games and simulations and things like that. Now, when Elon moved to Austin, he closed down the school, but his sort of co-founder in that school, Josh, spun it out and joined by a friend. His name is Chrisman. They created a school called Synthesis. So Synthesis is the online version of the SpaceX school. It is based on games and simulations, and now they have an AI tutor as well. And that's the best thing I've seen in terms of creating this environment for learning, like you're talking about. And I think that's going to be the way. Like, can you imagine doing it with VR? Mm. We really can simulate with AI and VR. We can simulate environments that will kind of set people up for the future. I think it's a really exciting area, and I wish more talented entrepreneurs would go into education.
I think the interesting part there is, in a world where skills are now democratized and we're using AI tools and agents on our behalf to do a lot of things for us, for me, it seems like the only differentiator is agency. Is now that these tools are at your fingertips, to what extent can you rapidly evolve, learn them, and apply them to particular use cases in your life to build real things? Like, education's been so conceptual and we're just studying things. But for me, I don't believe learning takes place when you consume knowledge. It happens after you've got a result and you validated that you actually were able to learn something, apply it, and get a physical result that validates that you actually had that learning. And so in a post AI world, it seems that high agency and exceptional taste are the only thing that people can truly rely on.
100% agree. Being generative. Mm. Being able to generate a lot of ideas.
You mentioned that. I loved what you said. Like, in a world where anyone can build apps, like, ideas become the bottleneck. And that's kind of contrary to a lot of advice we get, which is like, ideas are bullshit and it's all about execution. But if we have tools and software now that can actually do a lot of the execution for us, then ideas now become the bottleneck.
Yeah, I've never believed that. I do think that people outside of tech put a lot of emphasis on ideas. It was like, oh, I'm gonna create this patent for this idea. They think that's how you get rich, right?
Yeah.
But so for a while, I think it was a good heuristic.
Yeah.
But like, if you look at the history of technology, ideas were very, very important. Like, if you look at Bitcoin is based on a lot of different ideas, but there was one novel idea, which is, the solving double spend problem using proof of work, right? Yes. And so you needed this one idea that everyone missed for 30, 40 years. And this guy does that, and it it births an industry and a new type of money. That's going to be the bottleneck. You need to be able to generate a lot of ideas. When you have these agents doing a lot of work on your behalf, you'll be able to test a lot of ideas.
How do you think about that? Because now it's such an exciting time because thanks to Replit and some other great tools, non-technical people can bring their visions to life, right? It's remarkably empowering. If you have an idea, you have more tools and access to actually alchemize that into material form than you ever have before. But I think a lot of people struggle. How do you come up with ideas? What are the building blocks of a great idea? And you have the idea of scratching your own itch and finding something within your particular domain. But do you have any, I guess, mental models around how to come up with good ideas?
First of all, love ideas. You have to, first of all, stop believing that ideas are bullshit and start believing that ideas are valuable. Traditional advice and like brainstorming, sitting around with someone, really thinking through things, spending a lot of time thinking. And, someone like me, I am like, end up being very forgetful, end up like misplacing things because of. I'm always thinking. So that's the negative side of it. It's like I can't turn it off, and it's like keeps going. I'm like always thinking of ideas and
Nonstop.
not nonstop. And there are a few heuristics. One is find a certain trend. Assume that we're gonna live in the world where this technology gonna reach maturity, and then ask the question. What does that world look like, and what kind of products and services or tools that can build to service that world?
So you're anticipating the future based on a trend. And then saying what will need to be true, what will need to exist to empower this future that I'm anticipating.
100%, 100%. Like this is really where the best ideas come from, and very few people kind of think they can like predict where things are headed, but. It's often not very hard to have an idea of like, for example, when I was coming up, the web was growing really fast, and I remember seeing like Gmail, and Gmail was the first kind of like JavaScript app where you don't have to refresh the page every time you go different. It felt like an application. I saw that. It was like, oh. It's kind of clunky, it's slow, but where's that headed? Like clearly this is a kind of a superior experience. And then it's like, okay, if that's going to be the dominant way of building software, then I need to learn JavaScript and I need to be the best at JavaScript. And then everyone around me was like, oh, JavaScript is for web designers, not for real programmers. So of course you need to be the kind of person who is not is not overly conformist because it's easy. Like, ah, oh, I'm not a web designer. I'm a
Did
real
at the
programmer.
time, did you know that JavaScript would end up having full purpose, full stack application and end up being the preferred choice for?
No, I didn't go that far. I just felt like we call them Ajax applications. Like the client-side applications are going to be an important part of the future. That's all I needed in terms of an axiom. Is that perhaps the main way applications are built? They're not Flash, they're not desktop, they're JavaScript application, and therefore JavaScript's going to be important.
What did this look like if you extrapolate that into Replit? Like, what was the key insight to build Replit, and why was it the right time for it?
So a few trends kind of related to that. JavaScript was getting a lot faster. V8 had come out. V8 is Chrome's JavaScript engine, and that kickstarted a race not very different from the LLM race. So you had V8, and then Firefox came out with their JavaScript engine, and Apple came out with JavaScript Core, and there was this benchmark race on how fast they can run JavaScript. I was like, okay, this is going to get pretty crazy. And so, what kind of applications can you build? Well, it's not just the Gmails of the world. Can you actually build a compiler? Can you actually build an interpreter? Can you build those kind of things? And I was like, okay, well, maybe we can run full development environments in the browser. So that was one insight. Another insight was more people would want to program. And the reason I had this kind of insight is, well, first of all, it was hugely impactful in my life. Like, I started making money at a very young age. When I was early teens, I started like making software and building businesses. And I'm like, this is hugely empowering. And I think this is going to be not only a really big career, and by the way, that's like in the 90s, it wasn't really clear that computer science is going to be this important thing. It wasn't even considered engineering at the time. And it was like, okay, this is a hugely empowering thing. The internet is growing really fast. Businesses are going to move online, and therefore a lot more people would want to participate in this thing that we're calling software, that we're calling the internet, and programming is going to be a crucial part of that. So whether it is learning to code or whether it is like simpler environments to just make applications, there's also another interest of mine, which was programming languages. I was really interested in learning a lot more programming languages. So this confluence of interests ended up being, okay, so I want a portable programming environment that can run anywhere with a web browser, and that can like perhaps save my code and make it really easy to make certain small things.
Initially,
So
were
that
you
was
building it for yourself?
yeah.
Ah, okay.
I tried it for myself. Like I just wanted to be able to like go to school and use the computers at the lab and boot up Replit or something like it and in code or learn or do my homework and then go to work because I used to work at the time, use my work computer and had the exact same development environment. So I really wanted that and I would have been satisfied to just use it myself.
Was what allowed Replit to be so such a breakthrough? Was the launch of GPT critical to that, or what was the inflection point that allowed you to like cross the chasm?
There were multiple inflection points. You're right that the crossing the chasm was AI. There was a bunch of S curve, I guess. The first one, like I talked about, just the web getting faster, more powerful, collaboration. So we were kind of the first to kind of have a fully collaborative programming environment. And when COVID hit, everyone was at home and they needed a programming environment that is collaborative for various reasons, whether we're learning to code, whether I'm interviewing someone remotely, hacking on a side project with someone, whatever it is, from the base most basic usage to like education to actually more advanced software engineering usage, some people kind of flocked into Replit. With the advent of AI, Replit became a lot more valuable, partly because we have a lot of code, we have a lot of people that generated code, and so we're able to train models early on that was like state-of-the-art code models. So that was another inflection point. The big one that was most recent, when we just like made the decision that we want to be for everyone. And we always wanted to empower a lot more people to code. But like late 23, early 24, we're like, we're just going to be a platform really for everyone to be able to make software. Based on that, I was like, what kind of technology we need to invent to get there? The right thing to do was to invest in agents. And although they weren't ready early 2024. Again, this is one of those things where there's a trend line and you could potentially see where it's headed. And it was really clear to me that the language models are becoming more action oriented. They can take actions.
So that was the insight.
Yes, that was, we had the early tool calling and function calling, and it was clear that they're headed in the direction they're going to become more action models. And so that's when we really bet on it.
That's another very interesting topic, is 12 months ago, I didn't know anyone really talking about agents. You might have had a jump on me being more technical in the ecosystem, but can you bring people up to speed that might not be familiar? What is an AI agent, and how are agents reshaping business and work?
Think about ChatGPT. It's a chatbot. You send a message, it responds with something. And since 22 when it came out, up until like last year, it was basically that. Now agents, and we've always, AI people have always talked about agents. Agents have a few characteristics. One is that they can take actions. So not only they can chat, but they can call into the web. Book a flight, call into Python, like, have tools, have the ability to branch out. The other one is the ability to work at least semi-autonomously. The ultimate agent is fully autonomous. Some level of autonomy is required because you want to send a request to an agent, and the agent needs to work, do tool calls, and keep going until it hits a terminal point and return to you and just say, "Hey, I did all this work. Here's what I found." And so, if you look at self-driving, we had autopilot. I think there was three versions. There was autopilot, self-driving, and then there's now FSD, full self-driving. And so every one of those is di different levels of autonomy. And but agents have can have a varying degrees of autonomy, but the most basic agents need some level of autonomy. So when you put these characteristics together, you have an AI. It could still look like a chatbot where you send a prompt to. In the background, it will do some actions on your behalf. It will loop as many times as it needs to and then return something to you. So now, going back to ChatGPT, now it's they're starting to have some agents. So deep research is an agent. It can work for 20 minutes autonomously. So you give it a request, you say, go research this thing. And it's going to go to the web, it's going to open a bunch of websites, search, open a bunch of websites, maybe call into data science tools, Python, whatever, and do that for 20, 25 minutes until it's satisfied and it feels like it's got everything that it needs, and then write a report for you and return it. So that's a form of a very simple agent. Now, something like Replit Agent is about creating software. So we give it a lot more tools. It's not just search the web, it is write code, debug code. Execute a file, deploy, provision a database, migrate a database. And so it is up to 100 tools, and that gets it, that makes it a lot more complex.
So the AI agent can call tools and reason and perform actions. So in terms of what this means for work now, does that more or less trend us to smaller companies, more senior people with taste, cutting out 50 to 80% of junior to mid-level hires that did all that manual work, and you just have smaller, dense, very senior teams?
I think so. I think so. I think companies will be smaller. I think there's going to be more companies, which is
More
exciting.
companies, but smaller.
More companies, but smaller. Yes. The first thing that people will start to think about is the social impact of this. And I do think it's going to be disruptive. Like, I don't recoil at that. I think it's going to be disruptive. But it's been the case forever. Like, the Industrial Revolution was
Look
hugely
at the
disruptive.
internet. I mean, companies that didn't get on the internet bandwagon that stayed offline couldn't compete with companies that learned how to market online. Like every wave, there's some need to adapt, but that is what makes us human, is the ability to adapt.
Yes, absolutely.
I'm curious, what's the most interesting or impressive thing you've seen built on Replit so far?
I can tell you about how the enterprise is using it, and it's also fascinating seeing young entrepreneurs build businesses that reach revenue scale that took Replit years to reach. They reached it within like 3 months. There's an entrepreneur, his name's John, on the platform, who built an education platform with Replit that is both for individuals and for the enterprise. It has courses, it has assessments, interactive assessments, it has degrees and all that stuff. And it also has enterprise management, seats, admin, all of that built entirely with Replit with no coding. He doesn't know how to code, I believe, or didn't code. In the first month, he made 180,000. Obviously, he's someone with a skill. He's an educator as well. He knows all of that. But he was restricted. He was held back by the lack of coding ability or skills. And now he's unrestricted. So Replit is a platform. You still need skills. It's near, we just like we just lift you up, and then based on your ambition and your grit and your ingenuity, you can make insane amount of money. And these guys are just, it's very inspiring. They're like better than me because I actually had to learn how to build a business. As a software engineer, I was just like always distracted by making cool shit. And then only recently I'm like, okay, building a business is actually it's actually freaking hard, as you know, making a business.
where you can make more money than you lose
Yeah,
is
that's a lot harder than it seems. Do you
yeah.
think this idea of the one person $1 billion company, is that hyperbole, or do you think that's actually going to be a reality soon?
If you look at a company even like Replit, we have more million ARR than we have employees. There are companies that are doing even better at that than us. Cursor
Cursor,
famously.
Mercor.
Yeah, Mercer. How many people in Mercer?
I think Mercor has about 30 people and they're well beyond 100 million in revenue.
It's almost there. Like the Cursor guys, like what, 50 people? There's 10 billion dollars. And so, if they're 10 people, it's like 1 billion per head. So it's we're not that far away from that. It's a big difference between like 50 and one, but it used to be 5,000. Like we're orders of magnitude better, right? And so clearly the trend is smaller, smaller companies having larger and larger market caps. And yeah, of course it's going to happen. That's what I was talking about. You see where the trend is going.
Actually, if you think about it, Ilya already has this, it's just him and he's got a
Yeah.
$30 billion
Yeah.
company.
That's cheating though,
Do you
yeah.
think, like, what's your, just a quick aside, what's your take on that? Like, Ilya raising at 30 billion, Mira raising at 10 billion. They're completely betting on the talent, not the actual product or revenue. Is that smart or do you think that's crazy?
So I was talking to a friend and I was being perplexed about what's going on here. Like what are these VCs expecting? Like what kind of returns are they expecting when you do a seed round with $1 billion? And he's like, look, these VCs are guaranteed 1x their money. If there's an acquisition, like if they fail, Mira and her cadre of amazing AI researchers will at least get bought by a billion for a billion. And maybe they have it in the terms even that they need to get 1x or
Some
something like that.
pref, yeah.
It seems plausible to me. It already happened. So Character AI, when they got bought for 2.5 billion, Google doesn't want the asset. They just want Noam, like one guy, $2.5 billion. There's very limited downside. And now the question is like, how much is the upside? Well, if AGI is correct, there's like almost unbounded upside. And so from an EV perspective, I think these people are make sense of it. I wouldn't invest on these valuations personally.
Yeah, it's a little bold for me. But dude, I'm curious because in light of these shifts that we're seeing from earlier in your career when you started Replit to where you are now, we've talked about how important it is to build a team, right? Talent density is king. What are some of your philosophies and learnings on building a world-class team? And is anything shifted for you in the last, call it 4 or 5 years?
Originally, we were playing the Moneyball game. Those who haven't read the book or seen the movie, it's about a sort of an underdog team with a very creative coach that created a team of misfits where they all have one ability that they spike on, and then they're actually quite bad at everything else. But then when you put them together, it's almost like putting together Lego. You end up with an entity that's actually quite strong. Early on in Replit, especially as someone who's when we first started, I didn't have a lot of clout. As an immigrant, we didn't have a big network. I wasn't like a Stanford dropout like a lot of the guys at companies. And so one of the first hires was like this 18-year-old kid who, I used to joke say that he's a runaway kid. Almost true. He kind of left Santa Cruz and went up to the city to SF to kind of become a programmer. He joined Hack Reactor. Hack Reactor was a boot camp and that was a customer of ours. So the guy running it sent me a bug request or a bug or feature request. I'm like, look, I don't have enough programmers. Send me your best guy. He's like, look, this guy is really awkward, but he's really great. He's really young, he's really awkward. So he comes in and I'm like, yeah, I'm fine with awkward. I worked with plenty of awkward. And so you find this talent that is underpriced. We get to the inflection point at sudden in the pandemic with kind of mostly misfits and those kinds. Now, as you build the organization up, I think those people are still useful, but you want people with more experience, more training, things like that. Luckily, at that point, we had already sort of built a brand about a high functioning, highly capable team. I had raised money from the top investors. I created a narrative and a story around the company that allowed us to sort of attract talent. Now, that kind of spoils you a little bit because you almost never build the outbound muscle. And this is where your team comes in. And now we're starting to get better, a lot better at outbound because we were so comfortable depending on inbound. But right now we're at a stage where we need this like very senior folks to kind of take us to the next level. And I think this is where we're at a place where we're still learning.
I'm curious because I think a big part of your strategy too is you've built a very attractive brand in the market, right? You have a super viral product. Everyone's talking about it. Everyone has great things to say about it. Like, were there any specific things you can attribute that virality to that allowed you guys to take off?
Remember I talked about the web and Gmail and Ajax and all that. I always thought that it is very important for everything to be shareable, for everything to be URL shareable. There's been online IDEs before, but they weren't URL shareable. You can't like build something and share it. So Replit has always been shareable. Like you can invite people, you can send them a URL, they can fork your app, you can deploy it and have a URL ready and send it to someone else. So that built-in virality helps a lot. Also, you realize that if you make it possible for people to make things they're proud of, they're gonna share it around. That's very important. On the sort of more engineering side, we've always been big believers of writing highly technical blogs and sharing what we learn through videos, through blogs, through tweets and all of that. And so we've always had an active blog. We were in Hacker News and Reddit all the time. And I would say that the final point, which may be a little idiosyncratic or harder to do, although more and more people would do it now, is I built like a more of a personal brand, one where I try to position Replit as a very different culture and perhaps contrasted with the zeitgeist at any given point. When the sort of woke culture was the dominant one, we were like the anti-woke company. Right now, perhaps we should go woke because the anti-woke is the dominant culture. But you have to differentiate and you have to be a little bold, and people are attracted to boldness. Don't want to be bold because it alienates other people, but actually you can never be attractive without alienating. And so this is the thing that people understand. Like there's no company in the world, there's no leader, there's no personality in the world that is not polarizing to some extent. And so the reason that a lot of people recoil at the potential to be enigmatic and sort of attractive for certain talent and for certain customers, for certain people, is because they never truly express what they're about and their values, because they're always worried about offending someone or another.
That's a bold stance you take, and I do think that that's played a part in your success. You built a founder brand, you've got a big network, you're big on Twitter. When things happen, people are like, what's Amjad saying about this, right? And it's a lot of people that are loyal, raving fans of your products too in the developer community. Was that a difficult decision to make? Because I can see a lot of founders thinking, hey, I'd rather just shut up because I don't want to lose customers, right? Or I don't want my VCs breathing down my neck saying, why'd you say this thing about this current event? Was that like a conscious choice for like, hey, like I just have to do this? Or like, curious if you think this is a good move for other founders, or if this was just, hey, I'm unwilling to live my life constrained with and not use my voice.
It needs to be genuine. Like you need to actually have opinions. You need to be an interesting person who have opinions about the world, right? I mean, and a lot of people just don't, which is fine. A lot of people are like single-mindedly focused about a certain thing, and a lot of people are really brilliant at that.
Like Brian Armstrong.
Yes.
He might have opinions, but he doesn't want to share them.
Yeah. But although he actually ended up being hugely popular because he took a stance against the insanity in at the time in San Francisco, right? Like, so
Right. Yeah, the
when he wrote,
crazy DEI stuff, and he's like,
yes.
no, like, get back to work.
Yeah. So yeah, actually, he's kind of a counterexample because
He
he
ended
ended
up
up,
doing that, you're right. Because
yeah.
in saying, hey, we don't do politics here and we don't talk about social events, at the time, that was actually a polarizing stance when everyone was expected to do it.
Exactly. Exactly right. So I think you need to be interesting. You need to have opinions. You need to have a worldview. You have to have courage, and you have to have self-belief. Like you have to be okay with the risk, like a risk of getting canceled, or the risk of not being able to raise capital, or something like that. Like, so you have to understand the risk, and if you feel confident, and if you feel strongly about a certain subject, and you want to talk about it. The tech world was shifting so much towards the founder. That was pretty obvious to me at the time. The business world was becoming more persona and more sort of founder oriented as well. Like, so you had obviously you had the rise of Elon and the Elon brand, but you know that was a trend that was happening for a long time, but it started accelerating. You also had Trump, right? Which is you know it's like what Trump, you know, I'm just talking about it in an objective matter, not in a sort of political way, but what Trump showed in 2016 on his rise is you can be anti-fragile in a way. Like you can, and I'm not suggesting people do any particular thing, but like the new media landscape meant in a high velocity media landscape meant that any certain event will only last 10, 12, 48 hours. So even if you get canceled, you only get canceled for 12 hours,
Yeah,
and
even
then
if
the
you get
world.
shot in the ear and almost get assassinated, people forget about it 2 days later.
Yeah, exactly. It's so crazy that no one talks about that anymore, and no, there's no investigation. We haven't heard anything
The world
from
moves on so fast. I think now
Yeah.
we have an overcorrection because there was so much suppression of voices that weren't conforming to the status quo narrative that now I think, along with this shift in AI, we're celebrating individuality more again. The media has shifted to corporate controlled entities where you're reading off of scripts and catering to sponsors. And more people, it's decentralized in the same way AI and software development is, where everyone can build a podcast, everyone can build a blog, everyone can build their own show. And I think in this world, that's actually a great message and calling for other founders and builders to, like, good marketing repels and attracts, right? It's like, define what matters to you, define your values, express that to the world in an authentic and genuine way. And that actually allows you to have distribution to the entire world and magnetize customers, relationships, opportunities in ways you just didn't have access to before.
It is counterintuitive for most people because we grew up in a world of being disliked is like the worst thing that could happen to you, and like the way the media and like Disney movies or whatever, it was like always programmed to be a certain level of conformism. Very hard for people to
Isn't
break
that
that.
funny how when we're younger, all we want to do is fit in? All we want to do is be normal. And then when you get older and you're like, wait a minute, normal kind of sucks. Like
It's
living,
a prison.
it's a prison. And you realize, wait a minute, life actually begins when you have your rebirth, when you have your awakening of, like, you know what? I realize that most of who I am is just conditioning I learned from other people. And now I get an opportunity to create myself freely without constraints and rethink why I believe things and choose who I want to be. And when we get later in life and we mature, all we want to do is be unique. We want to be seen for who we are. And it's really this process of unlearning to become who we already were.
And by the way, this is like full circle to the start of the conversation when we talk about how education changes. We talked about, you know, ancient Greece, right? I mean, and the Stoics. This was all it was always about. It was like who you are, what are your thoughts about the world, what's the good life? You know, that's the book I've read about the Stoics. It's called The Good Life, because that was the whole thing. It was like, how do you find the good life? And by the way, it's a different answer for different people.
What is it for you? What is a great life, a world-class life from your definition?
I like achievement a lot. Like I've always been like I like winning a lot, and so I competed my entire life. I started initially competing as a swimmer, and in various sports. I was always like school president and all that stuff. You try to be the coolest person in the school, and then I competed in esports, like in gaming. Nothing I would do just for fun. I always wanted to be the best. That's sometimes not great because you're
Is
never
that driven by a pure inspiration or is that driven by insecurity?
both, probably.
Oh
You
man,
know.
because I can deeply relate, and I've been thinking about this because I think motivational fuel is a really important thing to examine within yourself, right? Because if you're building your entire life from a place of not enough and of exhaustion and of lack and fear, you're going to achieve a lot of great shit in life, but you're going to look back and it won't fulfill you because you're constantly empty. And the story internally is you're never enough. So no matter what you achieve, it'll never be enough. And I think about shifting motivational fuels and doing some more inner work. And I'm like, wait, you can actually build from love. You can build as an artist and create masterpieces and really just compete with yourself and the art you want to create versus over-focusing on being better and overcompensating than other people. And I've put a lot of thought into that lately because I'm the same way. I feel like if I'm not the best at something, I'll have passions like salsa dancing or paddle, and they start out as passions and fun, but within a week I'm like, I have to be the best, and every day that I'm not the best is torture. And so
Yes.
it's like I don't know if it's a gift or a curse.
Yeah. It's probably both. I'd still do have fun, like drifting, car drifting, and I'm like, oh man, this is the best thing. But I just want to learn, keep getting better at it, and then I get to a point where I just want to test myself against other people, and then suddenly it is a competitive thing. And the craft is very important, what you just talked about. When I'm not in the mode of I need to close this deal, I need to close this whatever, I need a business mode of winning, which is in business mode, you have to be a killer. Like there's no way with it, right? Like it has to be pure competition. But when I work on product or engineering, that's fully for the level of the craft. Like I enter a mode where I'm not really thinking. I actually tell people just stop talking about competition when we're in this like creative space. We don't talk about competition. We just build the best thing possible for our customers. And you enter a very almost trance-like space where like truly creative spaces where everyone is on the same wavelength are very intoxicating. I'd be curious about what kind of sort of inner work you've been doing. What does that look like? Is that
I
psychedelic
was
or?
actually going to ask you the same because I'm so curious about like what events and ideas shape people. Because for me, I was 24 and I was 23, made my first six figures, thought I would be the man, and I was like, all right, I'm still not it. I still don't feel enough. I ended up leaving my job. I traveled to 25 countries around the world. I was in India becoming a yoga teacher, taught English in Ghana and Kenya, all these cool things. Came back, had a bunch of awesome Instagram pictures. But then I realized I had all the same problems. And I was 26, 27. I was like, okay, clearly the problem's inside of me. So I started doing all these seminars. One was called Landmark. I started doing a bunch of meditation retreats with this guy named Joe Dispenza, hired a bunch of coaches, did somatic therapy. I was just looking for any edge, any insight I could get into myself to see what are the limiting factors in my own mind and the stories I'm telling myself that are constraining me from living the life I want. And it was funny because my entire life kind of got unlocked from this one moment at this one event where I had this big dream of being a leader, starting a company, changing the world. And I was like, I had this gnawing sensation in my stomach that I was built for something big, but I couldn't move myself to action. I had too much doubt. And I ended up being at this thing called the Landmark Seminar where you examine your life and you get insights into your blind spots. And I realized when I was 12 years old, I lost this baseball game to go to the World Series. I was the last out. The team blamed the entire loss on me. And I can see their faces in the dugout, throwing their hats down. They wouldn't talk to me. And in that moment, I said, never put me in charge. Never put me in a leadership position again, because I'll let everyone down. And from the time I was 12 to 27, all I did was focus on overcompensating and trying to be the best at everything because I was so insecure, when all I really wanted to do was be a leader and do big things in the world. But all my behavior was counter to that desire because I was so insecure and needing to overcompensate and so afraid of letting people down. And then when I discovered that and I saw that it was a false belief, that was a story from a 12-year-old that I was still living as it was reality at 27, I decided to discard it, create a new possibility. I was like, I want to go build schools. I want to go build a company. And in short order, I had built a nonprofit, you know, over 2,000 students in schools, rallied teams, raised funds, built a company, scaled it to multi-million dollars in monthly revenue. All these things from unlocking that mindset constraint that was this governor over my life I didn't even know existed. And so I'm a huge advocate of people going to seminars, reading books, getting coaches, helping them unlock their own minds so they can tap into who they are and actually leverage their power.
That's awesome. That's an inspiring journey. I'm definitely on a similar type of journey where, like, when you're C'd all the way up to like A or perhaps B, and you're kind of broke and all that, you're just like, you don't have any time. And like, then if you have a family as well,
yeah,
and you're just even taking care of your health kind of feels like changing a tire on a moving vehicle, because you can't stop. And you're like, if you're dealing with a serious health issues, it's really bad as a founder, because you can't even find the time and energy to go do that. But you know, I got a bit of a liquidity event initially from a previous startup, got a little more comfortable financially, create a little bit of time for myself. And initially that took the form of sort of exercise, which I hadn't done in a while, some form of like mindfulness and things like that. And I also like just the basic things, just being in the sun a lot more, just like makes me a lot more grounded.
Mm-hmm.
And doing all the hippie shit, like grounding is actually like eating well, eating like more whole and raw foods. I use as little chemicals and plastics or things like that as I can. For my skin, I'll use tallow.
Uh-huh.
Instead of some of the chemicals, I just try to use as much like animal based products as possible. Like all these things, just made me healthier and therefore more space and more time to kind of ponder so the good life. So I think people underestimate how important it is to try to find balance. And try to find, and like a big part of balance is not waking up being fatigued, not being bloated all the time, not having like random health issues, having more energy in the day, perhaps eating less and skipping meals. You'll feel like you have more time. And so there's all these basic things that most founders don't think about that I think start to play a big part.
I think that early founders have to go through that where they're like operating in pure ignorance until the pain hits them. Like I remember I was doing 5 a.m. till 10 p.m. 6.5 days a week for the first couple of years. And in hindsight, I could have worked 20% less and probably been much more productive. I was just completely burned out without knowing it. And I think about it kind of like a NASCAR racetrack. Like you got to change the tires before you need to, right? You're changing the tires so they don't get overtreaded. You don't need to. You still got 4 or 5 laps in you, but you got to do it in advance. And I'm like, all right, I think about it differently now, where I'm going to work really hard and really focused, but I care about the quality of my focus and my engagement. And when I have things on my calendar that aren't work related that fill my soul, whether it be time with friends, vacation here or there, salsa dancing, whatever hobbies I have, I'm more in love with life. And the more I'm in love with my life, the more energy I bring to my work, versus when I'm in a dark hole for 100 hours a week for years on end, I start losing passion for life. I'm like, what is my life anymore? And so I find that I don't believe in the concept of like pure balance. I think harmony is an interesting concept, but like, it's just making sure you're catering to the multidimensionality of who you are. You're taking care of your health, your spirit. And then that gives you the energy to put the best version of you in your work.
When you are in this painful state and you're putting in hours that are mostly spinning wheels.
Yeah.
When you seek pleasure, you seek the most base, the most destructive type of pleasure, whether it's like gorging on food, smoking weed, you know, whatever it is. And like, I'm not judging anyone, but like for me, the kind of things I reach towards are very numbing, because that's what you need. You need to be numbed after all that pain.
Just want to smoke a joint and eat a Big Mac.
Yeah. Yes, I mean that sounds amazing actually, but I haven't done it in a long, really long time. But the kind of pleasures I seek right now, now that I feel like there's more, like you said, harmony in my life, tend to be more on the virtuous side. There's time with family, simple things like a you know, walk or hike or time in the. I have a small spa in my house, like a sauna, cold plunge, hot tub. You know,
yeah.
Like, that's a huge reset for me. You know, especially cold and hot. Sometimes I'll do 2 hours of cold and hot.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, I'm just like a, you know, clean slate. I don't have any looping ideas in my head, or I'm like, oh, that person said that, or that I feel slighted by this. It's like all these petty things that starts in my brain. I feel like completely reset after that.
Dude, I love that you're saying this, man, because I think every founder, every person who's interested in a high performance, high quality life at some point has to arrive at this. It's like, the better you take care of you, your mind, your mental, your spirit, your body, you unlock incredible power you didn't know you had access to, that you couldn't really even see from that prior state. So I love that you're in that zone in your life, because I think it's your best work. And I notice now I could technically work a quarter as hard now and still produce exponential results. A lot of the parts, both because we have really amazing teams behind us, but I think that is an extension of our quality of thinking and kind of the pureness of spirit from being in alignment.
Yes. I love the words you use, alignment, harmony, things like that. That's exactly.
Well, building a business is a spiritual journey, you know, like it's going to test you. It's going to reveal all your insecurities. You have to give up more control, have more faith. You have to empower other people. It forces you to confront your blind spots and your inadequacies naked out in the arena. And it's like, you know, the more you focus on this inner journey of cultivating yourself into the type of person who's able to do things, you can basically penetrate any goal, because you are the common denominator. And I think that's where a lot of people, I think from this conversation especially too, should be inspired to focus on more.
Yeah, 100%. Like I think that it is a bit of a cliche thing about Silicon Valley that founders tend to be a little different, and you know, starting with Steve Jobs and his spiritual journey,
yeah,
and all of that, and people make fun of that, like, you know, the Silicon Valley show had a guru or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Hooli CEO
Gavin Belson, I think.
Gavin Belson, he had and this guru guy that's around him, that's trying to scam him all the time. But it is a spiritual journey, and it is in most of that. What's holding you back is you. Just a scary concept, because if you fail and it is out of your control, it's fine. It's not going to destroy you. But if you fail and you had, you know, and it was within your control, that's scary. And typically it is, in a way, like, you know, what's holding you back is some kind of bad habit, some kind of like unclear idea that you weren't seeing, some kind of thing about you or your company that is not able to attract the right talent and capital and support or something like that. And then you really, once you embrace that, it starts with you. And again, that's another thing that we were taught, especially sort of in the Western world and the Western media, is like being selfish is such the ultimate sin. But in reality, things that people interpret as being selfish or self-centered is counterintuitively the base for which allows you to be more altruistic and generous, which is when you start with yourself and put yourself in a position, what you call harmony, then you can be your best self to be a kind leader, to be generous, be in service of others. But if
Being selfish is actually the most selfless thing you can do.
yes, something like that.
What I got a few more questions for you, but just to touch on this thing you mentioned, you are your biggest enemy. You are the thing in your way. What was that for you, or what was one of the insecurities or internal obstacles that you had to conquer within yourself to be who you are today?
Self-sabotage is a big one. Like when I'm under stress, I would just do things that make the stress worse. Like I used to smoke, like cigarettes, all sorts of types of nicotine. Like I'm the kind of person who's like more attracted to the uppers kind of mood drugs or things like that. Like not hard drugs, but caffeine, lots of caffeine, nicotine, like anything that can like they can put me in the next level. But like those things like that are heavy on the cortisol side of things, less relaxation, less sleep, and I find myself ramping them up as I get more stressed, which you want to go to the different direction. And yeah, the sort of pleasures, whether it's food or other things that are more destructive. And then I used to get sick a lot. I used to get, depressed or crash, go all this high, and then you crash and you don't get a lot of sleep, and then you're in the sine wave, and then you make bad decisions. And but I think more recent, I felt like I was able to conquer that, and then that set me up for better decisions, more long-term thinking, being more available because I'm getting sick less, I'm getting, I crash less.
I think that's amazing, man, because I think if people want to reach their next level, you kind of have to do this self-examination of what are my energy leaks? What are the vices, the habits that I'm doing that are stealing my power and hurting my self-esteem that I can remove and by definition gain more power just by a process of removal? So addition by subtraction. It's similar to like Michelangelo when he built David. He had a block of marble and he's like, I just removed everything that wasn't David. And there he was. And so, like, our greatest selves are already existing within us, but we just have to remove all the bullshit that's
Yeah.
stealing our power so we can access who we are.
If you're overweight, there's a jacked person
Yeah, there is
underneath.
a jacked motherfucker under
Yeah.
that skin, just waiting to
Yeah.
emerge.
It's true because when you gain a lot of fat, you're also gaining some muscle.
It's true.
So
Yeah, just to support the extra weight.
but
Amjad, I got one last question for you. First off, have you seen The Matrix?
Oh yeah, of course. I used to be a huge fan.
Okay, amazing. It's one of my top three favorite movies, but there's a character in that movie called Tank, and he's the guy who programs Neo with all these kung fu skill sets and all that stuff too. If you were Tank and you could program the minds of every human in the world, what is one skill or trait that you would program into every human?
Yeah, there's so many trite things one can say here, but like obviously self-awareness and all that, but it's obvious, it's also vague. The meta of all of this is sort of like a reflection, is the willingness to have a model of yourself no matter how painful. Modeling yourself is actually quite painful, meaning like truly understanding how people see you and perceive you. People recoil at that, which is why people don't like to watch themselves. People don't like to listen to themselves. There's something almost horrific about yourself. Right? Most people, it's just like this simple thing, people don't like to listen to their own voice. And like most people just don't have a good model for themselves. And I think being able to understand how other people perceive you, not because it matters exactly how other people perceive you, but that also gives you an idea of like how you truly are, and not how the modified vision of yourself is. And by the way, this is both positive and negative. I think depression is partly you having a incorrect
model of yourself, but more on the negative side. Like you think somehow you suck in all these different ways, which might be very untrue.
But most people probably don't spend enough time reflecting and examining themselves to then
Yes.
make the necessary changes to say, hey, how is what I'm thinking, who I'm being, what I'm doing, how is this going to extrapolate 10, 20 years from now? Like how, what adjustments do I need to make within myself first to see the changes I want in my external world?
Yes,
That's
exactly.
powerful, man. That's deep. I like that.
I really enjoyed this conversation. I think, yeah, I don't really talk about this kind of stuff on most of the podcasts. So
No, I
I
know.
think
You're
yours.
usually just jamming on super deep technical AI stuff, but I wanted to get into your mind and how you think about life
Yeah,
too.
that's awesome, man. That's a really great conversation.
Amazing. Well, thank you for coming on. I'm John.
Of course, my
Good,
pleasure.
man.